truth, Danny saw. Do we have to talk alone? He asked Loki. Loki studied Danny for only a few moments, but in those moments Danny felt the gate thief's gates stir within him. You have something that I need, said Loki. Take them back if you can, said Danny. But I warn you that I know enough now and have power enough that I can take the rest whenever I want. Danny was telling the truth as far as he knew it, but he also had no idea of what defenses Loki might retain, especially now that he had passed through a great gate. You misunderstand me completely, said Loki, and I have no desire to hide from your friends the thing I came to get, the thing I need so desperately. If not your gates, what? Asked Danny. Your trust, said Loki. Danny looked at Anonoe. Is that why he brought you? To use your man-magery to make me trust him and not you? If that were his plan, said Anonoe, is it working? No, said Danny. Then I think you can safely conclude that this is not his plan. Whatever he wants from you, he hasn't told me anything. Trust isn't a prize in itself, said Danny. What do you need my trust for? There is a war much older than you, much older than myself, said Loki. A war as old as humankind, between the Bell God and the Mither Mages. Danny waited. I need you to take over my work, said Loki. I know you don't trust me, and the very fact that I said this much has raised your suspicions even higher. Yet the war must be fought or lost, and I don't have the gates to do it. The job of protecting against the Bell God is yours now. Danny thought again of the runes he had read in the Library of Congress. Hear us in the land of Mither came. Hear us among the great ships of Iceway, among the charging dunes of Dapnudap, among the mages of the forest and the riders of the wold. He was reciting in the old language of the inscription, a language Loki had to know. Fistok, or something near it. The language of the Norse as it had first been bent and twisted by the Semitic language of the Carthaginians. This is very old, Loki murmured. Where did you learn it? Danny went on reciting. We have faced Bel, and he has ruled the hearts of many. Bold men ran like deer from his face, but Loki did not run. I am not that Loki, said Loki. You know the tale, then? Asked Danny. Is this the war that you're still fighting? He thought he had won, just as I thought I had won. But we never win. He can't be killed, and he outweighs any wall we raise against him. Eventually it wears down. He keeps returning. Was he dropped into the sun? Asked Danny. Did he somehow live through that? His body died, of course, said Loki. But his in-self can't be killed any more than yours or mine can die. But we do die, said Danny. Our bodies die, said Loki. But you know our outselves can outlive the body. Those are the ancient gates that I kept captive for so long. They're still alive in that wild gate. But without an in-self, said Danny. Don't be a fool, said Loki. They only live because the in-self also lives. Wherever it is, the out-self draws its life from there. The wild gate is filled with the rage of those in-selves, so angry that I took their gates from them. So the in-self of Bel did not die with the body. It took him 1,000 years to return to Middlegard, and his rage was terrible. What did he do? Asked Danny. Not as much as he intended, said Loki. He conquered everywhere, but I closed all the gates against him. He couldn't possess any of our mages and follow them to Westall because there were no gates, and as the power of our mages in Middlegard faded, he gained less from riding them. How would you know? Asked Danny. After the gates were gone, you were gone as well. If he had not been prevented, you would not be alive to talk to me. The language of Westall would have died in this world. There would have been no gate father from any family to create a great gate. I knew because you existed, that for 14 centuries I had kept him trapped in Middlegard. And you fear that now he'll break loose and come to Westall through the gates I make? I know he will, said Loki. And since I can't prevent him, and you don't know how, then I beg you to trust me. Let me teach you how to do the things that in all of history before me no one learned to do. You alone can learn them. The eating of gates, said Danny. The poem you were reciting to me, said Loki. That Loki ate gates, as did the Persian gatefather whom Belgod had captured and turned to his purposes. What is it that you do, then, that you would teach me? Asked Danny. Don't believe him, said Marion. He's promising you power. It's like the temptations of Christ. It's exactly like the temptations of Christ, said Loki. Only not the way you think. You've heard about the Christian God? Asked Leslie, incredulous. I exiled myself from Middlegard in 632, said Loki impatiently. The Roman Empire had fallen. Christians were all over Europe. Byzantium ruled the East. Of course I know about the Semitic gods. I studied in Egypt. I had all the Gospels. I had the ancient Coptic lore. What do you think I want to teach this boy? How should we know? Said Marion. If we knew it, we would have taught him ourselves. Teaching you is the most dangerous thing that I can do, said Loki. Because once you know it, if the Bell God captures you, then all is lost and Westall is undone. Don't teach me then, said Danny. But only you have the power to stand against him. Look at me. Think what I did. If I had the power to stand against him, do you think I would have eaten all the gates and run away? I have no more power than you, said Danny. You have 1,000 times my power, said Loki. And that is what it's going to take, my knowledge and your power. But you have to trust me, and I don't know how to win your trust, because you know better than anyone what liars we gate mages always are. I don't always lie, said Danny. Only when you speak, said Loki. I'm not just like every other gate mage, said Danny. I made the choice not to lie. Too bad, said Loki. Because unless you can lie with the expertise at lying that comes from long practice, you will lose against the Bell God because he is the father of lies, and yet you must deceive him or you are doomed. Do the job yourself, cried Danny. I couldn't do it even if you gave me back my gates, Loki answered him. Even if I ate this wild gate, as long as you are alive in the world, he'll lay his traps for you until he has you. And then you can make 1,000 gates to let him through, and he'll use your millions of gates to rule both worlds, and none will ever stand against him, not in 1,000 years, not in 10,000, not in 1,000,000,000 years. Danny didn't know whether to believe him or laugh, so he made a joke. Well, there is the heat death of the universe. I have no idea what that means, said Loki. The ultimate result of entropy, said Danny. Loki looked at him blankly. The end of everything. Fool, said Loki. There is no end of everything. What you call dying or ending is nothing but changes in the shapes of things. Who told you such nonsense? Only Belgod benefits from telling such a lie. Danny leaned on the table, burying his face in his hands. Even as his body spoke of weariness, though, he remained alert, in case Loki tried to do something sneaky while Danny was thinking about the distracting things that Loki was telling him. And in that moment, Loki struck. Danny could feel it inside himself, in his heart hoard, the place where he held captive all but 8 of Loki's gates. A shifting of the 100,000 gates that were Loki's outself, for now he could feel them all and knew the number without counting them. 143,994 gates, and every one of them moved within Danny and became Danny's servants. The shouting stopped. except the feeble struggles of the remaining prisoners that Loki had captured long ago. All of Loki's own gates, the ones that were a part of Loki's outself, fell silent. No, not silent at all. They turned attentive, alert to Danny's own will, as alert to him as Danny's own gates were. "I give them to you," said Loki. "What does that mean?" asked Danny. "They're yours to build with," said Loki. "Yours to weave. If you use them, they won't turn wild. They can't." "You can't give me something that's a part of yourself." "Yes, I can. And yes, I did," said Loki. "How else will you trust me? But they're still a part of you." "That's true," said Loki. "The ones that are still inside you will continue to show me what you think and remember, what you see and do. I can't help that. It's how the world works. But believe me, they're yours now. I couldn't take them back unless you freely gave them back to me, which I hope someday you will. But if you never do, they're yours forever." "Or until I die," said Danny. "Or until the Bell God takes you and it all belongs to him," said Loki. "This is the only way that I can earn your trust, to show you how completely I trust you. The only reason I withhold the 8 gates you left to me is because without them I can't help Annonoe or Sed on Westel. I'm going there now, if you permit it. I'm taking her back there with me." Enop had been listening, rapt. But now he looked worried and spoke up.
"Taking her?"
"Yes," said Annonoe. "And leaving you here in safety, if we can."
"No!"
shouted Enop, jumping up, knocking his chair backward, though it didn't fall.
"You can't leave me here!"
Then, to Danny's surprise, to everyone's surprise, Aluic's hand shot out to rest firmly on Enop's shoulder and push him back and down into his chair. The older boy said nothing, but Enop fell silent and looked at him. Then he burst into tears.
"He says I have to stay," said Enop. "And he does too."
"He didn't say a thing," said Annonoe. "It's his outself," said Loki. "I can see it now, hiding inside Enop. It's where he went when I held them both in prison. He must have sent his outself to comfort his brother through their captivity. He's been riding inside his brother all along." Leslie immediately stepped forward to put her hand on Aluic's head.
"I should have seen it, but it never occurred to me. Yes, he's riding him like a heartbound."
"So you can break the link?" asked Marion.
"I've never tried with a man-mage," said Leslie.
"He's a man-mage?" asked Annonoe.
"No," said Loki. "Not necessarily. He's too young to know what he is."
"He's too young to have sent his outself," said Marion.
"But he did." "He didn't know what he was doing," said Loki. "He couldn't have. It isn't magery, not with any kind of skill. And if you tear them apart against his will..."
"How do we know what his will is?" demanded Annonoe. "He was taking care of his brother, but maybe he didn't know how to get back."
"Like an outself trapped in a bagged-up clant," said Danny, remembering when he'd tied up some of the cousins.
"Exactly like that," said Marion.
"This boy took such care of his brother," said Leslie, "completely forgetting himself. I never heard of such love."
"You want us to take care of these boys," said Marion.
Loki said nothing. Danny understood now. He wanted someone to take care of them. He and Annonoe have work to do, and they want the boys out of danger. But he didn't know you existed.
Loki looked at Annonoe. She buried her face in her hands.
"I don't want to leave them."
"But you also don't want them with you," said Loki.
Danny looked from Marion to Leslie, the two of them now standing behind the boys.
"You want them, don't you?"
"They started doing magery far too young," said Marion. "Who knows what that does to a child?"
"I did this to them," said Loki. "I had no idea this could happen, but at the time I didn't care. And now they're still in prison."
Eliuik's fine, said Einop. He says to leave him alone.
Nobody's going to do anything to him, said Marion.
Not me, anyway, said Leslie. I think he has to learn how to bring home his own outself.
She looked to Loki.
He's just lost, right?
No, said Loki. It's not that simple. His outself and inself aren't fully separable. He's too young. He sent his outself before it was safe to send it. So it's still bound to his inself. Both parts of him, the Ka and the Ba. He's as much inside his brother as inside himself. It might kill him to separate him from his brother. His inself might also be lost.
He's not lost, said Einop. He's right where he wants to be.
That's because he's young and stupid, said Loki. What he did was kind. No, it was noble. But his body can't last like this. His Ka has to come wholly back inside his body. As it is, he is in very grave danger of losing his body, and then he would only live inside you, Einop.
He can stay as long as he wants.
It doesn't work that way. Right now, the only reason he hasn't taken you over is because he's still partly connected to his own body. But if he ever lost that, then the two of you would fight for control of your body.
No, we wouldn't, said Einop.
Right now, Einop, said Loki. Who said that? Was it you, or was it Eliuik talking through you? Einop fell silent, thinking. Exactly, said Loki. Eliuik sent himself partly into you in order to protect you, to watch over you. But if he doesn't get back inside his own body, then his body will die sooner or later, one way or another. And when that happens, Eliuik will become like the Bell God, a loose Ka attached to another person's body.
You keep saying Ka and Ba, said Danny.
If you trust me, I can teach you, said Loki. Meanwhile, these boys are bound together and they don't want to change. For all we know, Einop is silently begging his brother not to leave him. He might not even know he's saying it.
I'm not, said Einop. He can go if he wants. I'm not afraid anymore.
Eliuik may not believe that, said Loki. Or he may not know how to leave you. Or he may be even more afraid than you ever were, Einop. He might have been coming to you for comfort. I don't know. You don't know. He doesn't know. But somehow he has to sort it out and get back entirely inside his own mind and outside of yours, or he will become something terrible. Einop got a stubborn look on his face. It was identical to the stubborn look on Eliuik's face. The only difference was that Einop was looking at Loki, and Eliuik wasn't looking at anybody. Nobody's going to force you to do anything, said Loki. Isn't that right? Loki looked at all the adults. Anonoe showed grief and fear on her face.
I can't leave them.
You aren't with them, said Loki. Not as much as they're with each other. Loki spoke to Marion and Leslie. Danny trusts you. He loves you. He has enough of me inside him that I can see how deep it goes. You're good people, as far as he knows. Is he right? No absurd modesty here. You mean no harm to these children, right?
I would never let them come to harm, said Leslie.
Marion nodded, but he looked worried. Danny understood. You can't watch over the Wild Gate and these boys at the same time. We can watch over anything here on our farm, said Marion. But I can foresee a circumstance when the things we have to do to keep other people away from the gate would be the opposite of what we would need to do to keep these boys safe. You have to watch the gate, said Loki.
Screw the gate, said Danny. Protect the kids.
You say that because you don't know what you're talking about, said Loki.
He says it because he's a better man than you, said Anonoe.
I don't deny that, said Loki. But Danny North doesn't understand the monster that we're at war with. Not the families, but Belgod. I would rather see these two boys torn apart by dogs than let Belgod pass through a great gate. Before anyone could do more than gasp or groan at his heartlessness, Loki raised a hand. If you knew what I know, you'd feel the same. A terrible enemy is poised to rule both worlds with irrevocable power forever. It would never, never end. Do you understand me? Especially if he ever got control of Danny. To keep that enemy from achieving that kind of mastery, that infinite evil, I would let any of you die. I would die myself if by dying I could be sure of stopping him. He looked so fierce that the others remained silent. That's hypothetical, Danny finally said. You want the boys safe, and you want the gate safe. So do we all. But you don't get to decide what Mom and Dad do if push comes to shove. They decide. So the question is, are you going to trust them with the boys, or not? Loki put his hand to his forehead. I can't expect any of you to understand what I know. How could you believe it, even if you understood? He rose to his feet. Anonoe, if I can give my gates to Danny North, you can give your sons to these good people. He took your gates. I did, said Danny. But then he gave them to me. I'm not sure how he did it, but they're obedient to me. Either give your sons to Marion and Leslie, or stay here with them, said Loki. With you or without you, I'm returning to Westil now. If I let you, said Danny. You couldn't stop me if you tried, said Loki. I could eat that wild gate, said Danny. If you could, you already would have, said Loki. Can you? Asked Danny. Because if you can, do it. 3/4 of that gate is yours, said Loki. I don't have the power to swallow any gate of yours. But the quarter of that gate that isn't yours, you don't know how to disentangle it. You don't know how to swallow an active gate that isn't your own. Teach me, said Danny. It can't be taught, said Loki. It can only be learned. I can't even demonstrate because I don't have enough outself to make a great gate and show you. And besides, I would never be so arrogant as to make a great gate with angry captive outselves bound up in it. In other words, said Danny, you never thought of it, you never tried it, and now you want me to feel stupid for doing it. Loki looked at him for a long couple of seconds. Gate mages all think they're so smart, he said. You'd know, said Danny. Loki reached out a hand to Anonoe. Are you coming with me or not? I've been in the same world with the Belgod longer than I should. He knows me, and I'm in no shape to meet him now. So I'm not waiting any longer. Anonoe gave her sons one more agonized look. Aluic, Enup, I love you, she said. I promise I'll come back. Please obey these people, and above all, find a way to separate and become yourselves again. Now, said Loki. Anonoe took his proffered hand. In that instant, they were gone. Danny felt the gate that Loki made, and felt it disappear the moment they had passed through it. Loki had gated to the barn, and no sooner had he and Anonoe got there than Danny felt them pass once more through the wild gate back to Westil. "Is Mother going to die?" asked Enup. "No," said Leslie. "Let's not start by lying to these boys," said Marion. "We don't know what she and Loki are going to do, or how well they'll do it. But I believe she does mean to come back for them, if she possibly can."
"I wasn't lying," said Leslie. "I was encouraging."
"Loki is the oldest, wisest mage in either world," said Danny. "And he's looking after your mother." Enup nodded.
"And are you going to teach me how to be a gate mage?"
"If that's what you turn out to be," said Danny, "which we won't know for at least a few more years."
"Is that a promise?" asked Enup.
"It's an honest statement of my intentions at this time," said Danny. "But since I don't know the future, I'm not going to make any promises I might not be able to keep." Danny spoke over Enup's head to Marion and Leslie.
I have to get to school. Are you all right?
Our lives just got a little more complicated, said Leslie.
But what could possibly go wrong?
She gave him her sweetest, most sarcastic smile.
That's why I love you, said Danny.
He gated back to his little home. Only as he looked at his own kitchen did he realize that he was so stupid he hadn't taken any of Leslie's bread with him to eat for breakfast.
Chapter 14. Loyalty. Kiel was as loyal a servant as a king could have, or so it seemed to everyone but himself. But Kiel knew that it was mere coincidence that created that illusion. In his 20s, he had been called Plank, because he was master of refitting of the king's ships. His own father trained him to the task, for he was Plank, son of Plank, son of Plank, three generations of master shipwrights, who could heal a damaged ship and make it whole again. Unlike his father, who was a grumbler and griper, Kiel, when he was still Plank, had never uttered a word of complaint. After the war with Gray ended badly, and the treaty forbade Iceway to have more than 6 small fighting ships, suited only for subduing pirates, Plank never criticized the treaty, nor said a word against King Priard's father for having started and then lost the war. Instead, he quietly set about repairing all the ships that managed to limp home from the war. 5 of the smallest and fastest, he refitted for speed, to skim lightly across the water in pursuit of pirates. The others, the great warships, he refitted so that even the most suspicious inspectors from Gray would see nothing but cargo vessels, suitable only for trade. Ships that wallowed in the water, sluggishly lurching from port to port. When Priard became king, he came himself to see what Plank had done. He stood on a tower overlooking the harbor and watched the clumsy cargo vessels that once had been proud warships, as they bumbled up the Greybourne to the docks, or yawed their awkward way downstream, barely manageable from the helm. Priard did not complain either.
"You have kept my father's word," he said to Plank. "It is a good servant who preserves the king's honor."
"I am the king's true servant," said Plank.
Then, most softly, he said,
"Return at night and see my obedience."
5 days later, Plank was wakened by the hand of his youngest son, Nott.
"A visitor who has no name," said his son,
and Plank knew it had to be the king. No word was spoken, and only the most shaded lamp was used, casting a tiny bar of light whenever Plank raised the shield. He led his hooded visitor onto the most sluggish of the former warships. He dismissed the watch and took the king down into the belly of the ship, one deck above the bilge. Then Plank lifted a hatch, handed the lantern to the king, and plunged down into the bilge water. Rats squealed and scurried, but Plank paid them no attention.
"Cast the beam here," he said softly.
The king raised the shield and aimed the beam at Plank's hands. Plank gripped a lever that was snugged up under a deck joist and pulled it toward himself, moving it through an arc that was 1/8 of a circle. Where the lever had been invisible, now it was plain to see.
"What does it do?" asked the king softly.
"This lever is attached to a baffle under the hull. When the lever is parallel with the joist, the baffle is extended. It catches the water and makes the ship move slowly and awkwardly. It's a home for barnacles. But at sea, far from shore..."
He did not say, "far from the observing eyes of the gray folk."
"A captain could send a trusted mate down into the bilge, to wade his way along the whole length of the keel, turning all these levers 1/8 of a circle, and then the baffles are drawn up snug against the bottom."
The king nodded. He was a sea mage. He understood that this would make the ship move much more smoothly through the water. The sailcloth, with its load of barnacles, would still be a drag on the ship, but it could be managed now.
"But the mate must be careful," Plank continued. "For if he turns the levers forward instead of aft, The baffles are completely released and fall away from the ship, leaving the hull smooth and clean. That would be a tragic accident, for the ship would then move as swiftly and surely as a warship, and some might think that the treaty had been violated. An awkward design, said the king softly. What madman would think of such a thing? I fear it was my own invention, sir. I'm glad the king will never know how clumsily I obeyed his command. You must be sure to acquaint every captain of this mechanism, and make sure they know which way to turn the lever, said the king. We would not want to find ourselves, quite by accident, with a war fleet of 100 ships, where the treaty binds us to no more than 5 fighting vessels. On your advice, sir, I will train the captains, said Plank. Every time a ship came into port, Plank would send his divers down to replace the sailcloth in the baffles and to make sure the mechanisms worked smoothly. But only those divers saw how the baffles were made, and only the captains of the ships understood how the mechanisms were controlled. It was up to the king to decide how large a crew these wallowing merchantmen would carry, and how well the men might have been trained for war. 2 years later, when Plank's overseer, the steward of the royal factories, retired, it was Plank, and not the man's own son, who was appointed to the post. "Because you serve me so loyally," said Priard, "doing for the king what the king cannot even think to ask." That was how Plank became Keel, master of shipyards, wagon yards, smithies, road graders, armorers, and all other manufactories that served the royal will. As Keel, he did all that the king expected, preparing Iceway to be constantly ready for war while seeming to be committed to peace, and keeping the secret of it from all but a handful of the men who labored under him. But the deepest secret of all was this. Keel was not loyal to the king at all. Keel was loyal to Iceway, not to the rocks and canyons, the fertile mountain valleys fed by icy streams, the great fjords that cut their way into the bitter coast, the islands where Icewegians kept their trading posts and fishing villages. Keel was loyal to the people, one by one and all together, the nation of Iceway. As long as the king acted in the interest of the Icewegians, Keel obeyed and served. But if the king betrayed them, Keel did what was right for the survival and the freedom of the Icefolk. That's why, as Plank, he had never shown the levers to King Priard's father, for he was the man who had lost the war and betrayed Iceway with a humiliating treaty. Priard, though, seemed to Keel to act in the interest of the people, and so he showed him the fleet that was ready for his use, should he choose to use it. But King Priard did not use the fleet. He was grateful enough. Keel's advancement to a place of greater trust and authority, not to mention wealth and status, was proof of that. But the king did not use the hidden war fleet. He stayed married to the bird brain of Grey, the useless Bexoy. He allowed the men of Grey to strut through the streets of Caimsham unkilled. He allowed the ambassador and his spies to have the run of the castle Nasasa without a taste of poison or the cold bite of a dagger in the ear. King Priard did not suspect that Keel was the center of a plot to kill Queen Bexoy and assassinate every Grey man in Iceway, because Keel was careful with his plans. No one understood the whole plan. No one knew any part but his own. It was to have begun with the poisoning of Bexoy, but the night cook of that time, the woman Hull, discovered the plan and blocked it. Keel arranged for her to die that night and began again. He knew of a much more foolish plan to murder Bexoy outright, one that originated among the Grey men. He was content to have the bitch from Grey be murdered by the hands of Grey, but that plot, too, was blocked, though this time Keel did not know how. A third time he planned, and this time he understood that King Priard himself would have to die. But not before his concubine, Annonoe, and her 2 sons were safely out of Nasasa and hidden where no one from Grey could find them. That was when Annonoe,
in the midst of preparing for a journey she had only learned about that morning, simply disappeared, along with her sons. Kiel understood then that even plans that no one knew about were somehow known. There was a man-mage in the castle, he realized. Someone who could peer into the thoughts of his heart. Or someone's thoughts. Someone's heart. Ever since the disappearance of Anonoe, Kiel had bided his time, making no new plans, watching to see who it was who had kidnapped or murdered Anonoe and her boys. He had watched as Bexoy gave birth to a darling child that everyone loved, hailing the brat as true heir, even though Bexoy was no mage and the child would surely be Drekka, or weak if he was a mage after all. He had watched as Priard trotted Bexoy out before all the people, and they began to love her instead of hating her as the symbol of their enslavement to Grey. He had rejoiced when that baby died, accidentally smothered by a pillow in his bed. The nurse who had been careless was promptly killed. Kiel would not have lifted a finger to save her. Fools deserve whatever comes to them. But at the same time, he was glad of her foolishness. But that same day, there had been a flurry of activity among the palace guards. Some business about rappelling down the face of the cliff below the castle and bringing out, dead, some squatters who had apparently been living in some of the ancient caves. How the squatters had got there, and how they had been supplied with food, no one explained, and when Kiel set out to learn more, he found that all the guards who had been involved in the operation were gone, sent away the same day. It was very strange, and Kiel did not like it when he did not know what was going on in Nasasa. He made no complaint at being kept ignorant. Indeed, he never showed interest in anything but his own duty. He was the perfect servant, the embodiment of loyal service to the king. But with Queen Bexoy so pregnant that she seemed about to burst with the next baby, the next heir whose succession to the throne would mean Grey's perpetual domination of Iceway, Kiel knew that it was time to act, and perhaps not subtly this time. What stayed his hand was the knowledge that he did not know enough. He still did not understand how the earlier plots had been detected and blocked. These days, Queen Bexoy took great care never to be alone. Priard also had her well guarded, too many guards at once. One man could be enlisted, another man bribed, but five? Six? Someone would blab or boast. Kiel had to find another way to kill her. Perhaps it would be enough to kill the king himself. What could Bexoy do with her child unborn? It was too uncertain, though, for Kiel to feel ready to act. Too many things could go wrong. Grey might leap into action, using the death of Priard as a pretext to seize power. Kiel's war against Grey might die before it had well begun. There was no point in creating chaos, if he was not prepared to turn it into a strong new order that would regain Iceway's freedom and power. If only Anonoe had not been taken. If only one of her sons were still alive. Someone to be a focal point for Icewegian patriots. Kiel would not be regent himself, but it would be someone that he trusted. Perhaps even Anonoe. Since she was no mage at all, and a compliant woman, she would be easy to guide. But she was gone, and so were her sons. It was a terrible time for those who loved Iceway. If only King Priard were a better king, and not the doting lover of that sparrow girl, Bexoy. It was one of Kiel's talents that he could conduct his ordinary business while plotting his plots. He did not have to talk his plans out with anyone, nor did he need to draw maps or doodle words and notes. He seemed to others to be busy all the time. They did not know what was going on behind his eyes. His meeting with the heads of two quarreling merchant families ended. He had almost, but not quite, grabbed them by the hair and banged their foolish heads together. They were both young, too young for so much responsibility. Only men who were old enough for their temper to be cool were fit to lead in matters of commerce. Or revolution? Or war? Sometimes Kiel even wondered if he was still too young. It hardly mattered. Since none of his plans worked out, he would be old soon enough. Maybe he needed to be more hot-headed and not so careful. Then again, hotheads were quickly caught and killed. Keel got where he was by being methodical and silent. As he was silent now, alone in his small office overlooking the armory yard, he strode to the window and looked out over the hum of activity. He knew the purpose of every man and woman who crossed the yard, knew what was in every wagon, what was being forged by every fire. "Do not turn from the window. Do not show any sign that you are not alone." It was a woman's voice. He knew the voice. It was Anonawe. But he did not turn. If she was alive, if she was here, then something powerful and dangerous was going on. So he said nothing, did not turn. He waited. "Now, as if you were weary of watching, close the shutter, my old friend." Wordlessly, for he did not want anyone below to glance up and see his lips moving, and thus conclude that he was not alone, he closed the shutters, and then turned. There she stood, looking exactly as she had the morning when he told her to pack for herself and her sons, only the smallest bag of the least clothes, only what she needed for 2 days. Instead, the foolish woman had made a big production of packing a trunk, and someone must have seen, must have said what she was doing, and so she had been taken. But she was still beautiful, still warm and comforting in the way she looked at every man. As so many times before, Keel thought, "I can see why the king loves this woman." He certainly forgot her quickly enough when she was gone. "I'm sorry I could not send you word before now," she said softly.
"I feared that you were dead."
"So did I sometimes," said Anonawe. "And other times I wished that I could die. But now, I am glad to be alive, and glad of my friends. Are you my friend?"
Keel shook his head. "I am the loyal servant of—"
"Oh, my dear old friend," said Anonawe. "I know what you are the loyal servant of."
"Who?" he asked.
"Some say you serve only your own career. Some say you serve the factories as once you served the shipyards. Some say you serve your family's ambitions. Some say you serve the king like his faithful dog."
"Dogs turn on their masters. When the master falls, when he dies, the dog will drink his blood and tear his flesh."
"Always a cheerful man," said Anonawe. "I know you serve something higher than your own career, higher than your family, higher than the king. I know that you are loyal to Iceway."
"Are you going to pretend that you share this loyalty?" asked Keel.
"Are you going to ask where I have been?" asked Anonawe.
"No," said Keel. "If you don't want me to know, then your answer would be a lie. If you want me to know, you'll tell me without my asking."
"My loyalty is to my children," said Anonawe. "But thanks to a trusted friend, they are now safe, in a place where no one can find them, let alone harm them."
"One might suppose that you are saying they are dead," said Keel.
"Not dead. Very much alive and ready to inherit the kingdom, if the need for that arises. But I hope it does not arise." Keel wasn't sure how to hear her words. With anyone else, he would assume that it was all a sham, that she was telling the truth by denying it. But there was something about her that made him think she might be honest.
"You hope the Sparrow Queen's wombling will take their place?"
"Those sons were born from love, not ambition," said Anonawe. "I think they will be happier not to be kings, or to be used by those who want to make them kings. But if they're needed, they're alive and safe. I thought you should know."
"It was kind of you to tell me," said Keel.
He let the tone of his voice say, If that's all, then go away. You're an amazing fellow, Kiel. A woman that you thought was dead shows up in your cell and you seem utterly unsurprised.
If I showed what I feel, then all men would know my heart, said Kiel.
Instead, only I do.
Your new friend is a gate mage, said Kiel, or else you could not have entered this place.
Be careful.
Gate mages have a way of running afoul of the gate thief and losing all their magery. You wouldn't want to be stranded somewhere inaccessible. I hope your boys are in a place they can walk away from when the gates are gone.
Anonoway smiled a thin but pleasant smile. Kiel was a clever man. He knew what the smile had to mean.
The liar told you that he was the gate thief, didn't he? Don't you know that gate mages can never tell the truth? It's against their nature.
Let's talk about what we're going to do now, said Anonoway. There was nothing overtly sexual or even ironic in her tone. And yet, what we're going to do now made Kiel's thoughts suddenly turn to the rumpled bed in the corner of the room.
Not now, said Anonoway, as if she had read his thoughts. It seemed some women could always read such thoughts when men had them. Or perhaps men always had such thoughts, so it took no great cleverness to read them.
I know you plan to kill the king, but I wish that you would not.
You do me no favor to say that, said Kiel. I have no such plan.
That was your plan when you told me to pack. I obeyed you, but made it obvious enough that surely someone would notice me and tell the king, so he could prevent my going.
Did he?
Someone else did, said Anonoe. I will not let you kill the king.
Kiel shrugged. Since I do not plan to do this awful crime, he began.
Then he found himself outside the door of his room. He had not moved, or rather, he had made no effort to move. Yet he had been inside the room, and now he was outside it.
The door opened.
Come in, said Anonoe. Do you believe me now when I say that you will not kill anyone I tell you not to kill?
So you're a mage, after all, said Kiel, re-entering the room.
Am I?
Or that gate mage friend of yours is listening, sending me here and there at your command.
Oh, no one commands him, dear Kiel. You have the magery of iron. It does what you command. Your machinery never needs oiling. Your iron never rusts. That is what you do.
And what do you do? Asked Kiel.
She reached out and touched his hand. All at once, his body filled with a bright longing for her to wrap her arms around him. And then, just as quickly, she shifted her hand, and he felt himself to be unworthy of her love. He did not want her to embrace him. He wanted her to overlook him entirely. She took his hand between both her hands, and all those feelings fled. Now between them there was only a deep, abiding friendship. The most important friendship of their lives.
Man-mage, he whispered.
I did not want you to think I was untalented, she said, or that my sons were only half-mages by their birth.
How can I trust anything I think or feel or decide if you can make me swing from one longing to another in a moment?
Don't base your decision on how you feel, she said. You never have. Why start now? I came to you because you're the steady one. You chose your loyalty and never wavered. I have no desire to change that loyalty, only to explain why your perfect loyalty should lead you to another course of action.
Another? Asked Kiel. I have no course of action, so I can hardly change it.
I will not attempt to control your decision, said Anonoe. But do remember how useless it is for you to try to lie to me. You're a subtle man, Kiel, and you tell your secrets to no one but me.
I have no secrets.
It will not be good for Iceway if King Priard dies.
Yes, my sons are alive, but I will not bring them back until they're old enough to stand up for themselves. This is a bad time for the chaos of a dead king without an heir, or with only an unborn baby to inherit. The Jarlingmoot will insist on electing an adult as king, breaking the line. But there's no one ready to stand as king. Not even you. He knew that she was right. I want Queen Vexoy's baby to be born alive, said Anonoe. It's good for Iceway if Grey believes that a half-grey child is next in line for Iceway's throne. Because she was communicating with him at levels deeper than speech, he understood exactly what she meant. You think the child can be controlled? I think the mother means to kill the king herself and rule Iceway through him.
And you think this is a reason to allow the sparrow bitch to live?
I think this is a reason to keep the king away from her.
I'll take her to an island far from here and strand her on the shore. Will that do?
She would burn the ship to the waterline before she'd let it take her anywhere, said Anonoe.
A fire mage, said Kiel. Not a feather girl.
A fire master, at least, said Anonoe. And so powerful she can make a clant that bleeds.
Now Kiel understood why Luvix had been so sure that he had killed Vexoy. I should have guessed it, said Kiel.
No one else did, said Anonoe.
Except you, said Kiel.
I don't guess, said Anonoe. You must be more patient than you have been so far.
What if I choose to ignore your warning?
Then I'll find someone else to help me, said Anonoe. And you can watch the people suffer as you destroy Iceway. As I said, my loyalty is not to Iceway, though our plans can help each other if you choose.
What do you want me to do?
Said Kiel, believing her, but also knowing that his belief was probably the result of her magery. Give me time, she said. Give me a chance to go work my plans in Grey. Let me shape events so Grey's ambitious heir grows impatient with his father. Let it be Grey that collapses in chaos, while Vexoy is here, nursing and protecting her second son. Let's see whether her motherly love is stronger than her ambition. Either she'll stay here and remain safe, or she'll go and leave her son behind. Kiel did not have to say all that immediately came into his mind. That Anonoe wanted Bexoy's son, and not one of her own, to be the pawn in the game of succession. That if Vexoy left her child behind, the child would be under Kiel's control. That if she took the child with her, King Priard would be without an heir if something happened to Vexoy and the boy. That if she remained here in Nasasa, under Priard's protection, then Anonoe would have a free hand to work whatever mischief she and her gate mage friend might be planning for Grey. It was a much better plan than anything that had been within Kiel's power.
I wish I could trust my approval of your plan, said Kiel.
I'm not that strong a man, mage, said Anonoe. I can't make you want what you do not want. I can't make you fear what you do not fear. I can't make you think of what you do not already know.
Then what can you do?
I can work on weak-minded people who don't know what they want, who aren't smart enough to fear what they should fear, and who think they know already what they do not know. That's the drawback of man-magery. All our forced servants are weak and dull. So I come to you not to be my servant, but to be my friend and ally. Kiel thought of how, at a touch, she had made him want her. But he must have shown on his face that he was thinking of this, because she shook her head. I did not make you feel what you did not feel, she said. I made you aware of what you had always felt. And he knew that it was true, that all the time the king had loved Anonoe, Kiel had also longed for her. He had such self-control that he had concealed his desire even from himself. But it was always there. Let's be clear on one point, said Anonoe. I know you have that desire, and I am specifically not exploiting it. Whatever you do, you must do it in the full knowledge that I will never
be yours. I have all the sons I need and want, and all the husbands, too. Do you understand? It was as if she had erected a wall of ice inside his loins.
I do not act for such reasons, he said.
That's why you're worth dealing with, she said. You're good at what you do, and I am good at what I do, each within our limitations. Mage against mage, neither of us is a match for Bexoy. Perhaps no one is in all the world. But we won't stand against her. In fact, we will stand with her, protecting her son. As long as she and that boy are alive, Gray will be torn apart by conflicting ambitions. And by her choices, she will reveal herself and expose herself and, in the end, betray herself.
You have a plan far deeper than the one you're telling me, said Kiel.
And you will have plans within plans. But know this. I keep my word. I know that you keep yours. So if you promise me that you will act together with me, then I know that you'll be my ally until you give me fair notice that our pact is over.
Yes, said Kiel. You understand me well enough. And I make that pact. I will not take the king's life. I will protect Bexoy and her baby. I will give you time to work your workings in Gray.
Anonoe smiled. I always knew you were the natural king of Iceway. Because only you act for the good of all, and not just for your family or your own ambition.
I have no ambition.
You have the large ambition of a patriot, said Anonoe. She took him by the shoulders and kissed him on the mouth. Not a woman's kiss, but the kiss of a sister, a friend. Count on me, and I will count on you. And then her hands were not on his shoulders, her breath not on his cheek. She was gone from the room, vanished in an instant. Her gate mage had taken her. And Kiel was left there alone with the deep longing for her that had never caused him pain before, because he had not known that it was there. He would die for her, kill for her. He loved her more than he loved his wife or his children, more than he loved his own life, more than he loved Iceway. If only she would use her power to take this powerful desire away from him. Yet, if he lost that desire, who would he be? What would be in his heart then, if she were gone from it?
Chapter 15. Running on Automatic. It wasn't a real track meet. Officially, it was an exhibition between two high schools, Rockbridge County and Perry McClure, months before the actual season began. More like two boxers sparring to keep in shape. Like preseason football. Like nothing. Only you never know that from the way Coach Leader was taking it. Apparently, the future of the human race depended on the outcome of every event. If a Perry McClure athlete won, the human race was safe for another year. If one of the kids from Lexington won, then the alien assault ship was that much closer to landing and enslaving all of human life. Leader didn't get angry at the losers. He got despondent. He even said, "We're doomed, we're doomed," even though his team was doing a little better than the other guys. When the manager, a sophomore that Danny barely knew, pointed this out, Leader looked at him with pity. "Oh, we don't suck as bad as Rockbridge. That's like going out with an ugly girl and saying, well, at least she's breathing." Since Danny suspected the manager had never gone out on any date, breathing would have been an improvement for him, but the kid wisely said nothing. Danny won the 1600 and 3200 meters easily, but Leader glowered at him and pointed out that he was nowhere near his best time. "It was a race," said Danny. "I won it." "But you didn't try," said Leader. "I didn't have to," said Danny. And then inspiration struck. "You want to show these guys my best? In November?" Leader thought about this. "So you think you're our secret weapon?" "I've only been running competitively for a few weeks," said Danny. If I'm a weapon, it's still secret from me.
Leader turned his back and walked away, which for Leader was like an apology. But then Leader got the bright idea of tossing Danny into the 200 meters with no prep.
I'm tired, said Danny.
You don't get tired, said Leader.
Of course I get tired, said Danny.